Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a premium interior paint and primer in one with a tough, lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Her career spans various racing disciplines, including IndyCar, NASCAR, endurance racing, of course, with accolades such as the fastest female qualified in the history of the Indy 500, the first woman to win a major open-wheel race in North America, and the first woman to be inducted into the Long Beach Motorsports Walk of Fame. Recently, she became the first woman since Danica Patrick to compete in a NASCAR Cup Series event and secured a top 20 finish at the Chicago Street Race, the best result by a woman in Cup since Patrick. And I am almost out of breath saying all of her accolades. Everyone, please welcome Catherine Blake.
Thank you. That was quite an intro there. You've been on the Googles.
Needed a drum roll while saying all of it, you know? It must feel great to carry all of this with you, you know? You have these stats to kind of padding your career and everything. You just keep accomplishing more and more and more.
Yeah, you have like a CVS receipt of accolades.
So what you're saying is I'm old.
No. I'm saying you've done a lot, which doesn't mean that you're old.
I've been around the block a few times. I'm very proud of some of the achievements. You know, I've had to beg, steal, and borrow and scrape my way through. And I was talking to somebody earlier about it. It's like I've never had the opportunity to be with a team that is championship winning for more than a season or two and really establish myself as a force to be reckoned with. I've had to take all the opportunities that come, including driving the car of almost certain death, as we nicknamed it back in the F3 days, and like really have scrambled to try and make a career. But that's made me kind of diverse and given me all those accolades, so I wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah.
Some would say you started the traditional way of go-karting, is usually the story of folks getting into racing. And so you started back in England. Talk to us a little bit about your dad's support getting into go-karting and now in racing.
So yeah, back in England. Although I've been over here for the majority of my adult life, so that explains the mid-Atlantic twang. Contrary to popular belief, I'm not from Louisiana. I started racing go-karts when I was 9, and I was really close to my dad, because from birth, my sister had a hernia, and so my mom and my sister were in the hospital for like a year or more together, going backwards and forwards, and so I was left with my dad. So I grew up driving on like his ride on tractor and throwing a ball and doing all the things that like a dad knows what to do. So my dad and I bonded, and I became a bit of an adrenaline junkie and a bit of a teen boy, and I wanted to climb trees and build tree houses and do all those kind of things. And then we found go-karts, and I feel extremely fortunate that I found something that I am so passionate about even now to this day. Like, a lot of people don't have that, but I have something that makes me want to get out of bed every morning. And I love racing. I was never a car nut. Even back in the go-kart days, it was about the competition and the competition with myself and the technology and the engineering and the science behind it and the strategy. Like, strategy is a huge turn on to me. And I loved everything about it and still do to this day. I just love racing. So here we are a lot of years later.
When did you realize that it was kind of no longer a hobby and something you really wanted to pursue?
It didn't. Still haven't. There was no defining moment for me. There was no point in time where I said, I'm going to be a race car driver. It just happened. And it happened through a lot of tenacity and not believing that I couldn't. So my parents brought me up to believe that I could be anything that I wanted to be if I put my mind to it. I actually wanted to be a fighter pilot. However, I couldn't do that because my eyesight is not good enough, so they let me drive race cars at 240 miles an hour. with context. I race go-karts. I really wanted to move into cars. We didn't have family money. I didn't have sponsors. I would write proposals and go around like industrial estates back in England and try and find the money to move up to Formula Ford or Formula Renault or whatever it is. I worked at Silverstone. I underwrote loans in a bank. I would stay up writing sponsorship proposals until like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, like just trying to do everything that I could to get the opportunity. The first opportunity, I don't know whether I've told this story, the first opportunity actually came with Lynn St. James and a lady called Catherine Nunn. And Catherine Nunn was the wife of Mo Nunn, and she ran an Indy Lights team. And he was obviously a famous engineer, crew chief, to whatever you say it. And they and a tire manufacturer were having a shootout to find the next female star. This was before I came to America. So this was in circa 2004, maybe three or four. And so I wrote to Lynn St. James, hey, I should be, it was in Autosport or whatever magazine that I got and read cover to cover when I was 20 years old. And I wrote to Lynn St. James and I said, you really should look at me. I want the opportunity. I deserve the opportunity. I just got Paul in my former Ford Z-Tech brand hatch. I beat Kimi Räikkönen's that record in a Formula Renault, like, I'm awesome kind of thing. And she was like, yeah, no, you're not American, and we have no idea what those things are, sorry. And so I said, okay, well, what if I just kind of show up and look and learn and meet people? And sure, so call my dad. I'm like, hey, I need a plane ticket. Phoenix, and I've never been out of Europe. Stop. So he gave me a plane ticket to Phoenix, and I had to pay him back. He probably still owed money. I don't know. And I showed up, and I had my helmet and my race suit. Obviously, who wouldn't? And she gave me the opportunity to drive the car, I think, because she felt sorry for me. She will dispute this story, by the way, because I was speaking to her. And she's like, it wasn't me who made the decision not to include you. It was Catherine. And so I showed up, helmet in hand, got in the car. They stopped the press conference they were doing with all the other girls that they had chosen. And they were like, okay, Catherine's our person. And it was me and this girl called Sarah McCune. And I wonder, to this day, I wonder what happened to her. Because we were both the chosen ones. So me thinking, this is awesome, I'm going Indy Lights racing, and everything's going to be sorted out, it then fell apart, and the sponsorship didn't happen, is so often the case. Mm-hmm. And so I was back to square one. But what it did was it gave me a little bit of a taste of American racing. I'd never driven on an oval before. It was Texas. And I've never driven such a high-powered car before, so I was super excited to try and make America my home. We saw Dan Weldon come over and do it.
Okay.
And, you know, I thought it's a land of opportunity, and they had Danica, and so they weren't going to see me as a girl. They were just going to see me as a race car driver and be a good prospect. So then that fell apart. So then Kevin Kalkoven was over in England buying Cosworth, which is was the performance brand of Ford. You know how like Toyota is like this,
yeah.
So there was this guy who owned the Champ Car series before it merged back with IndyCar, and owned a team called PKB Racing, and he was over in England, and I printed out my CV, my resume, and I drove my Vauxhall Nuremberg up the A40 and sat in reception until the reception lady would let me see him. She didn't call security, which was a plus. And his wife and his daughter came out and sat with me and said, hey, Dad, I think you should speak to her. I think there's something special about her. IndyCar, Danica, like, let's see what she's made of. So he came out, and I remember thinking, hey, thinks that I'm ridiculous. Like, I literally cried on the way home thinking that was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. But I wanted the opportunity. So I think you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable, and you have to do the hard things. And I think that it gets easier to be too comfortable later on in your career.
Right.
And so I did the hard thing, and I got a phone call 4 days later from Polestar, who are, so between Kevin and Polestar, they're responsible for my career, really. They took me in. I lived with them, Jim Griffith and Pam Griffith, and Jim taught me everything I know about how to set a car up and all the things. And we won 3 races, and we finished 3rd in that championship. We won the first one in Long Beach, and that kind of put me on the map. Here we are.
So it was this meeting that led to you racing in Formula Toyota Atlantic, which was, if people are listening aren't familiar, it was a feeder series to Champ Car or CART at the time. That year you had 3 wins and 5 podiums and 12 races. You made it very clear that you belonged there. You weren't just good enough to be a part of the series. You were excelling. And that next year, you tested for Minardi, correct?
Yes.
In Formula One. Yeah. What was that experience like?
It was awesome. It was very, very cool. I was not used to the driver aids, right? Like, the amount of technology that the cars had. I mean, the Indy Lights cars and the Atlantic cars back in the day are pretty rudimentary. It's like from a NASCAR. You get blisters on your hands and you're fighting it the whole way around. You get in an F1 car and it's like, all I can tell you, if you are a race fan, if you've seen Talladega Nights,
yeah,
and it's like the Jean Girard version of a race car. You know, it's very refined and has a lot of driver aids, and it's very different. But it's really cool. And so Paul Stoddard was thinking about putting me in that car for the next season, and then he sold to Red Bull. So my F1 dreams and aspirations went down the drain, and got me put to work.
I remember Oliver Gavin telling a story about driving, I believe it was a McLaren, and being given a giant binder with and having to like read up and study how to be able to operate a car. Was it a similar experience?
100%, yeah. Do you know what similar these days do? Is the LMDH car.
Oh, okay.
Well, it spells most of them. Like, yeah, you have to have a degree in engineering just to be able to read Finder.
Yeah. That next year, you then raced in Carter Champ Car with PKV Racing. In 2007, you went to Dale Coyne. And then for a few years, you went into sports car racing and then back to open wheel racing and IndyCar in 2012 with Dragon Racing. Then you went back to sports car, a few races in Formula E, which I've gotten a chance to work with. I love Formula E. But then in 2014, you seemed to find a permanent home for yourself in motorsport in IMSA, starting in prototypes and then switching to GTD cars in 2017, which is where, at least on paper, you seem to really hit your stride. And 2017, you had 2 wins, 4 podiums with Michael Schenck Racing, 2 wins and 7 podiums in 2018. What was it about that time and that team that you feel like brought you so much success?
It's all about the team and the car you're in.
Yeah.
But that's racing, right? You can you can do good things with the team on and off, but not permanently, if the team aren't up to much. And honestly, MSR was the best team that I've ever driven for in so many different respects. And they were just contenders every weekend. And it makes our job as a driver so much easier. Everybody got along. There was no politics. The car was fast and reliable every weekend. And like I alluded to earlier, like, I haven't been in a position like that before it or since. You know, my first season at PKV Racing when I went to Champ Car was great as a rookie year. Then they changed the car the following year, and I went to Dale Coyne. I never really found my stride that year. And then I did DTM 3 years with Audi. Because they merged with IndyCar. And so they had Danica, and they didn't want 2 girls back then. There wasn't room for more than 1, apparently. So
it's wild.
Shit, what am I going to do? So I bought mission, and I went home. And I was miserable for those 3 years, if I'm honest. Like,
yeah.
I did not have a great time. And I missed America, and I missed the it being the land of opportunity. And at that time, it was way more progressive for woman driver over here. So I was like, well, IndyCar, at least I get treated like I'm an equal and I get the equal opportunity and the team are behind me and all the things. So I came back. I had a miserable year in 2012 with Dragon Racing, where I had my sponsor yanked out from underneath me and it was a political nightmare. And then I got rescued by Don Panos, who invented the patch, you know, like the quit smoking patch and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a championship at the time. Again, they've merged now to make IMSA, but it was called ALMS, American Le Mans Series.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, do you want to drive the Delta Wing? I was like, I don't know, don't we? It was one of those cars that you either loved it or you hated it. But what it did was it gave me a frame of reference for being a development driver. So we worked on that car for like 3 years and we got it to the point where it was winning races and it was handling really well, and I learned a ton about what to do from an engineering point of view and how cars worked. And it was a really cool environment to be in, but it wasn't a competitive environment because it was a weird car. I mean, we did actually lead Daytona for over half the race, I think, until one of my teammates stuffed it. But it kind of gave me the tools that I needed then with MSR when the NSX came over, because it came over on a boat and it hadn't been touched by Japan yet, really. And so we developed the NSX into the race winning, and it's probably one of my proudest things, one of the best GT3 cars at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we were winning week in, week out. I had Andy Lally and I had Alvaro Parent as teammates, Mario Farnbacher at times as well. And man, it was a bad day if we finished off the podium. Like, it was a super bad day. And I guess I kind of just, I knew what I was doing in sports cars. I did it for so long that I could leave pit lane and not really think. You know, like, mm-hmm. your subconscious just takes over and you just do it. And you know you're going to be one of the fastest drivers. You know you're definitely going to be the fastest driver in that car, depending on what the car is. You know, I drove a Lambo, I drove a Porsche.
What else did my brother have? Anything better?
But I was just good at it. I was good in a prototype too, and like an LMP2 car and stuff. And it was where my frame of knowledge was, and still is. I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure that I could jump in half asleep and drive one of those cars decently quickly again.
Do you feel like I remember last year when you sat down with James Hinchcliffe and you did the Java with James, and you were talking about the adjustment in the IndyCar and how you could jump into a sports car, you could go to IMSA and do it in your sleep, you know what everything's doing, but coming back to IndyCar as a part-time driver, you're constantly like doing a mental checklist when you're in the car. Do you feel like you've had similar challenges and growing pains in Xfinity and Cup Series this year at NASCAR?
100%. I have to use all of my tiny brain. And I've hit the wall all the time, so it doesn't work that good anymore. No, I joke, but yes, when I first got back in the IndyCar, for sure, everything was a conscious decision. And if you think about it, if you're thinking about everything consciously, you're not doing it at the speed or efficiency that you're doing it if you're thinking subconsciously about things.
Right.
There's probably been hundreds of times where you guys have driven somewhere and thought, oh, I don't remember driving from A to B because your subconscious has just taken over. Or you're going around the supermarket, right? So it's almost like that in racing. If you can let your subconscious do the work, it is way more efficient, way better, way faster, way more reactive, et cetera, than consciously thinking about something. And I think I got to the point, I got a lot more comfortable in IndyCar last year when we did all the ovals. So I got up to, you know, almost that kind of feeling. But it takes you a minute. You know, it's been a decade since I'd been in one of those cars, and they have changed quite a lot. So it just took me a minute. And then I thought it would take me a minute in NASCAR too, but it's a completely different sport. It's a completely different frame of reference because I've never driven anything so big and heavy that moves around on the tires so much. The only ovals I've driven are in IndyCar. The structure of the races I'm not familiar with. I had to watch and learn and do so much work to figure out what's the chutes, what are the stages, mm-hmm. how does this all work? And even now, I had to text one of my buddies and go, what is that halfway through the season chase for $1 million thing? Like, I don't know. I haven't been there. So it's like a constant learning process.
Yeah.
I feel way, way more comfortable now than I did when I first jumped in it. When you first jump in it, you're like, don't forget this, don't forget that. You've got this to do, you've got that to do. And like, you've got people reminding you, and it's just a barrage of information instead of just relaxing and doing what you know how to do. You just have to build that muscle memory. It's like anything. It's like starting a new job. You start a new job at a new company, even though it might be the same as your old job in title, you still have to learn the different processes, the different people, the different where to go, what room is what, et cetera, et cetera. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I've been very fortunate to do the NASCAR racing experience at the Charlotte Oval at Charlotte Motor Speedway. And no, not that it's anything that you have done. I very fortunately got up to 138 miles per hour until I got too scared because you felt the back of the car start shifting when you're on the corners a little bit, and that nerve-wracked me. And then you have the professional drivers buzzing past you with their passengers. And I was like, I can't imagine doing this with 35-plus other cars every weekend. I can barely hold myself together, and you're so close. The pack racing is just so different, the skill set that you need, and it's just as scary.
It's so fun, though. Like, there was no pressure. Like, when I did Talladega this year, I was white-knuckling it for the first two stages. Like, I was, you're how close? Like, no, you're literally bump-drafting somebody. And then you get into it, right? And you get used to it. And I think if you had started off in something lower powered and you got up to speed and gone as fast as the car could go, and then you'd like stepped up, you would have felt very differently about it to them going, hey, how about it? Go do 138 miles an hour on a track that you've never seen before in a race car that you've never driven before. You know, I think that you definitely jumped in the deep end, but that's also a way to learn. That's what I did at Phoenix this year, I guess. But back to the Talladega thing, like, once you get comfortable, you realize that there is nothing that gives you that adrenaline. Or maybe Pikes Peak gives you a lot of adrenaline.
Yeah.
There's nothing that gives you that adrenaline buzz than like trying to figure out the strategy. And you see people getting a run. And you're like, okay, but this is that car. And that car's good in the draft. But this car is going to go up there. And that guy's teammate's over here. And they're working together. So I think this is going to happen. And it's like chess. And it's like you're trying to figure out what they're doing, as well as being flat out inches from somebody's bumper, trying not to get caught in everybody else's wrecks, with constant barrage of noise going on in your ear. And I've never had so much fun. Atlanta.
The amount of trust you have to have, specifically like on an oval in NASCAR, is something that I can never understand. Because we'll be watching sometimes, and I'll be like, oh, these are professionals, and nothing's about to happen. And then everything unfolds. Because someone just did something a little wrong, or like the risk of reward didn't work out, so... I was getting a little nervous.
The 40 best drivers in the world, or whatever the tagline is for NASCAR. You're like, really? Really, this is what we've got here? Because sometimes we all make really dumb decisions and mistakes, yep. But I guess we're all human.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Did you guys cross paths at Pikes Peak? Ash worked the broadcast this year.
Yeah, I was just stuck on the broadcast stage, yeah. Get off the mountain at 1 a.m., sleep in the car for the remaining part, right? Because it gets so much traffic, and then get on the broadcast for... For my first time, though, it's unfortunate that it was cut in half because of the wind up on the top of the mountain. I was... For you, it must have sucked. For me, it was not. It's on the broadcast booth because it halved the broadcast time for us, for sure.
That's true, but we were going after the record, and we weren't really racing anybody. So.
Right.
Double sucked, especially when you've been there for 2 weeks or whatever the length of time is that you're practicing. Did you get the chance to go up the hill?
Yes.
Okay, what did you think of it?
I mean, it was terrifying. I mean, we were just driving out, what's the speed limit up there, 35 miles per hour. And at some point, I forget where, at some point near like 13,000 feet, right? When you're going up in the corner, you don't see the rest of the road. You just see blue sky. And then you have to realize you turned. And I was like, this is terrifying. I don't know how they race this.
It's absolutely terrifying. But there's no adrenaline rush like it, right? Like, I imagine doing that as fast as you can.
Right.
And then forgetting which corner you're at.
We were making a joke on the broadcast because I've seen, right, drivers, they have their track maps for Sebring, you know, road courses and such like that. But like, what are you going to do for Pikes Peak? You'll have a scroll by the windshield that you'll have to pull down and hope that you remember where you are.
No, we learn it on the video or on a sim or something. I just did video and then hours and hours of like doing the first stage. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got that. Do the second stage. Okay, I've got that. But there are some places, as you know, having driven it, that look the same. So you're like, wait a minute, am I at the first one that is opening that I can go flat out through, or am I at the second one which is like tightening? And it would be desperate if you got those wrong.
Yeah, and I felt bad, especially for the cars, like the electric and the hydrogen-powered car and Daioshihara, because their advantages are at the top of the mountain, where the air density is less, and that's the whole point of them. But they only got to run halfway, so they really didn't get to showcase some of the cars. And then someone else built their Audi from, like, a 1/16th model, I think it was, that he had at home, and he just always wanted to race Pikes Peak. And I was like, that's cool, too. It seems like one of the last few pure kind of building this machine to take you up this mountain kind of communities.
Yeah, it's neat because it's the second longest standing race in America after Indy. So you go straight from Indy and then you do Pikes Peak and you're like, we're making history here. Speaking of history, it was really cool this year because Lynn was there, but also Michelle Vuitton. And Michelle has been a longtime friend and somebody who I've looked up to forever, right? Like, she was the mecca of women race car drivers. She won world championships in rally back when it was pretty misogynistic. And her attitude and her strength and fortitude and all the things, and she's still really nice and she's still giving back and did the Women in Motorsport thing for a decade. She's awesome. And I have definitely, like, worshipped her for the majority of my life, I would say.
She's fantastic. I got to talk to her, and obviously I asked, like, do you give advice? And she's like, I hate receiving advice, so I don't give it either. <She's> very honest. And I was like, I love this. Thank you so much.
So straight, isn't she?
I've talked about this with other women in motorsports, and I was talking to journalist Elizabeth Blackstock just before this call about, right, talking about women in motorsports. I want to talk to you, right, as a driver first and foremost, right? I don't want to be like, oh, women in motorsports and making it a thing, but at the same time, right, how can we not, in a way? And we constantly go back and forth, myself and Elizabeth, because representation matters just so much. For myself growing up as well, getting into motorsports, I know Elizabeth wrote an article about yourself and Sheena Monk as teammates in IMSA in 2023, Gradient Racing. And Sheena Monk also didn't want to focus on being a woman in motorsports. She just wanted to be a race car driver and people take her seriously. However, she told a story about when you got out of qualifying, excuse my language, but you were called a cunt multiple times to your face, which is gendered by nature. And there's instances, like on the Pikes Peak broadcast, people were commenting like, oh, DEI is ruining this broadcast. Why is this woman talking about racing here at Pikes Peak? I mean, at some point, when did you realize that maybe you didn't sign up to be a role model, but now you've kind of taken that torch and run with it?
I think it's been a gradual process, but I think it's been brought to the forefront by the partnership with ELF.
Yeah.
So before that, I was very focused on just being a race car driver and being respected as a driver and not playing on the fact that I'm female. And yeah, just... I hated the first woman to do this or woman to do that. I was like, I just want to be a race car driver. And then ELF came on board, and I had some really deep and meaningful conversations with their CMO, Corey. And even down to this past week, which I'll get to in a minute if you remind me, because my brain will go off and screw up. And I was like, you know what? I'm not excusing my French, but fuck it. I am going to be authentic and true to who I am. And that doesn't mean that I have to not be feminine or pretend to be something that I'm not. And I always use like Jensen Button or Lewis as an example, and I would like try and do what they would do. And I was like, why should I try and be a version of somebody else when I can just be me? And I've just been around long enough now that everybody has been telling me how to act or what to dress in and how to look and what to do. Like, don't wear too much makeup. We've got to wear enough makeup that you look like a girl. You know, all the things that we struggle with when we get into racing. And in the end, I was just like, I'm just going to be me. And I've been around long enough that you can take me or leave me. And Elf were like, yes, you do you, girlfriend. And even down to, I was on TV the other day. And they were like, look at those muscles. Because big arm muscles. Well, I have a lot of muscles because I work out a lot. And they were like, show us. And I was embarrassed to show them my arm.
Are you talking about the interview on CBS Mornings?
CBS, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
And I was embarrassed by it. And Corey, CMO, was like, you should never be embarrassed by it. You should be proud of it. You've worked hard for that. That's part of what you do as a job. And I was thinking about it. I'm like, why am I embarrassed about it? Is it because it's masculine? Is it because it's like bragging? Like, what is it behind that? And I shouldn't be. I should just be authentically me, and I should be proud of it because it's so... You know, it was a lot of work to get the muscles that I have. And so I'm still a work in progress. I cannot imagine being 16, 18, whatever it is now, with all the social media and all the barrage of abuse that you get. And, okay, I have a really thick skin now after 20 years in the sport that I don't care. In fact, I just think it's good because people are talking about me, and the more people talk about me, the more sponsorship I can get, and the more I can get a racing. So you carry on, guys.
Yeah.
But if I was 16 or 18 or even 20 and I had to deal with that now, I would not be handling it well. I was way more agile back then. And I feel bad for these drivers, honestly.
I want to touch on briefly about some of the negative attention you've gotten this year and some of the online harassment. I don't want to go too deep into that, but I do want to talk about you launched a podcast this year with iHeartMedia, Throttle Therapy with Catherine Legg. Has it been helpful or cathartic to have an outlet where you can express yourself and talk about what's on your mind in a public-facing medium that you control?
Yeah, it's been fun, actually. I didn't know that it would be fun, but it's been a lot of fun getting to speak to other people. I didn't actually want to do that episode. So the one where I addressed it, I didn't even address it. I just wanted it to die and go away because I didn't think that they deserved the recognition. And again, it didn't really bother me, but it was because of people bringing it to my attention. Like the agent for Elf, Clint, and PR lady Sonia, they were like, no, you have to address it for the future generations because, like, while you may be fine, there is a barrage of similar abuse going on across the board in different sports, different genders, different everything, and people think it's okay. And if you have the chance to have a voice and stand up to it, then you should absolutely use it. It's kind of your responsibility to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I addressed it and said that it's not cool. You shouldn't do it. And I stand by it. I think it's disgusting, honestly. I think it's social media giving these people a platform and a medium to have an opinion. And I also think that it's great that the NASCAR fans have such a passionate viewpoint, and if they don't like me, that's fine. I just think that they go too far, and I think that people think that it's okay to say these things online, and in reality they would never say it to your face, right? Nobody's come up to me and said, you should go and hang yourself from that tree.
I'm sure a lot of people that are giving you hate online, if they saw you in real life, would tell you they're a big fan and probably ask for a selfie.
Right. Or sign this diecast so I can sell it on eBay.
You're right. Good language. So, and in all reality, you're going to have people that like you and don't like you. And that's not just me. I think I was judged harshly, maybe, because it was me. But, you know, you look at it like Logano, Denny, Joseph, Bruce on himself a little bit. All the people, they also have people that like them and don't like them, and that's why we get paid to do the sport that we do, because of the fans. Mm-hmm. Because you have your favorites, and I have my favorite soccer players, and I have my favorite drivers, and all the things too, my favorite F1 drivers. If they're all the same, it'd be boring, but I just think it gets taken too far.
James knows I like to fight online. I kind of had the same. I grew up with Eastern European parents in New York City, so I have a pent-up rage, I guess you can say, naturally. But in my terms, I mean, exactly what you said beautifully, it's just that they can say this and they've been left unchecked, I guess, a little bit.
Yeah.
And if you're going to come onto my page specifically, it's not like if they tweeted something about me or whatever, but if they come to my profile and say something rude under my video,
right? Just delete it.
You... Oh, really? No, I start antagonizing.
On my page, I delete it because, honestly, they're not worth your attention.
Yeah.
Because you can't fix stupid.
Yeah.
You can try, but if you've ever gone on the plane and seen the people try and put their bags in the overhead luggage, then you know you can't fix stupid, so why try?
Yeah.
I will say there was one time where someone said something on a WTF1 video that was very offensive to Ash, and Ash and I, this is one of my proudest moments as a content creator. Ash and I bullied this person so hard they deleted their We like went to their page, we found out where they worked, we found out the name of their mom, we started being like, what would Cynthia think about this?
That's amazing. I love the amount of work and effort that went into it. You should see it as an example.
But going back to NASCAR, earlier this month in the Grand Park 165 Chicago Street Course, you finished 19th out of a field of 40 cars. First woman in top 20 in 8 years. How important was this win for your confidence in this series?
I think it was good to get the result. If you looked at Mexico, we were running 20th to 22nd before I got taken out by Jose Lan. Whole long story. And then in Sonoma, we were running mid-20s, and I got spun by Cindric. So I think the results would have been similar in both those places as well. It just happened the way the cookie crumbled in Chicago. But more than that, if you look at the lap times, like, I think I'm getting closer to the ultimate lap time, if you like, the leader, if that's the fastest car, I don't know, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's and that's what really matters, is learning the racecraft in NASCAR and being ultimately as quick as you can.
Yeah.
And that depends on the car that you're in as well, because like, if you're in a 30th place car and you finish 30th, then there's nobody that could have done a better job than you on that weekend. If you're in a 10th place car and you finish 10th, then it's a win, right? And I think a lot of people, again, circling back to our conversation earlier, a lot of people don't realize that racing is more about the team and the equipment that you are in than the driver behind the wheel. Okay, that's the last little bit. But you can drive Indy, and you can be in a car that is, and I was fortunate enough in 2012 to race for Sam Schmidt, and I was in a really good car, and that was just easy. Like, I could just, my grandma could have driven that car last, right? And then you get in a car that isn't as good, like when I drove the Red Bull car, which I thought was going to be awesome, and then it wasn't, and Graham has feelings about that too. Like, you're on the struggle bus, and I say this very often, that the guys at the back are working way harder than the guys at the front who are just turning the wheel. Because it's the majority car and team related rather than driver related. And while I don't think I'm capable at the moment of getting the most out of the car, I'm working on that. And then if I feel like I've got the most out of the car, which I do often in like the third stage, like the first stage is always super shaky while I'm like learning the roads, especially in Sonoma because we didn't qualify or practice because we had brake issues. So like I'm figuring out the track, the car, everything else going on around me. Then I get quicker in the second stage and we make changes to the car. And then in the third stage, I'm like, okay, right, let's go. I'm on the same zip code that everybody else is on and we can go fight them. So I feel like it's just a constant learning thing where sometimes I've shown that I belong and other times it's been understandable that I'm figuring it out because anybody in my position would be doing the same thing.
In Chicago, fans denoted that you and Elliot had some argy-bargies, you can say. Was that kind of like a friendly message to him because he kind of hit your rear bumper and you kind of gave him a little door and you're like, hey, I'm here. Or was that just more of, it's a Chicago street course and we were...
I'm so sick of being knocked out of the way. Every single NASCAR race, every single one. They're like, 78 car or 32 car, whichever series I'm in, and then like push me out of the way. Think of it as a rite of passage. I don't know whether I've got a chip on my shoulder because I'm like, why me? Like BJ said to me, it's because they see the 78 and they're like, we've got to get past that car as fast as possible. They do it to the 66. I hope it's not. I don't really know. But so Chase came up to me and actually in Chicago was a nightmare for the spotters. And I had a couple of spotters that weren't with us or hadn't been with us before. And on that part of the track, my spotter kept saying inside or outside and there wasn't and he would get it wrong. So at that time, I didn't actually know that he had a wheel on the inside of me. I thought he hit me from behind. So I was pissed. And so I just gave him a friendly nudge. Didn't do any damage or anything, but I was just like, dude, really? Yeah, it's not necessary. And then he came down to me after the race and he was like, I had like my front tire, your rear wheel. And I'm like, oops, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. So then maybe the retaliation wasn't necessary. Maybe he should have pushed me out of the way. But in my defense, I didn't know. So then no harm, no foul. And I don't blame Cindric for spinning me in Sonoma, really. I think, you know, these things happen. I've been taken out a lot this year. But things like the Hosovar thing, that really pisses me off because he just was like, oh, there's a car in my way, I'm going to push her out of the way. And like, didn't even, for maybe three corners, he was behind me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he's getting it back, but I'm not the only one who said that.
So you got to get in line. Ricky Stenhouse is first, and then it's and then I think it's a couple other people, and then I think it's you before that. So have any of the drivers come to you when you got into this for this year, kind of talk to you or gave you advice or something?
Yeah, some of them are really cool, actually. And like Ross Chastain, I knew from when I did the couple of races I did back in like 2017 or 2018. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Dinger is the friend of mine from 20 years ago because we raced in Champ Car together.
Yeah.
And then I've made some friends. It's like new school. It's cool. I like
it. We need some friends out on the track, for sure.
So I don't think I have. So he'll probably hate me telling this. But at Daytona at the beginning of the year, I went and sat in the Cowlick bus with Chris Rice and Matt Cowlick and Ty Norris. And and Chris Rice goes, ain't nobody going to draft with you. I was like, what are you talking about? Chris, yes, they will. If I prove myself, of course they will. He's like, no, they weren't. And I went to Talladega. I was pissed about this, by the way. And Ty was trying to placate the situation, saying, you know, no, it's just because you're new, blah, blah, blah. It's not because you're a girl. He was keeping Chris on the weekend. And I went to Talladega, and in the first two stages, nobody freaking drafted with me. So I went up to Chris Rice and he was like, you know what? You were right. Nobody drafted with me. And they were like, I told you, they're sussing you out and seeing whether you can walk the walk and whether they want to play with you, just like Ben.
Yeah. As they like to say, bumpers are made for bumping. a week ago.
Bumper cars should be the new training ground for NASCAR.
For yeah. Sure.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
A week ago, the news came out that you're going to be riding double duty this coming weekend at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, driving both in the Pennzoil 250 in the NASCAR Xfinity Series, as well as the Brickyard 400 in the Cup Series, one of the marquee events on the NASCAR calendar. You obviously have experience driving on this oval, having run the Indy 500 4 times, I believe. How different is your approach in a stock car as opposed to driving in a super speedway like IMS in an open wheel racing series?
A lot slower.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go out and hold it flat. So yesterday I was in North Carolina and I was driving the sim for Xfinity in the morning and in the afternoon. And so both of them are very different as well. I started off way overcharging the corner because I'm used to driving an IndyCar there. I've actually driven IMSA on the road course there as well, which is kind of cool. I love that I'm one of only a half of people who have done all the things. So I started off way overcharging the corner in the Xfinity car, and then by the time I got to the end of the day in the Cup car, we were actually really good. It was decent. And I was happy. It's just both of those are very different. beasts to each other, but there's no comparison to the IndyCar, right? So in my frame of reference, it doesn't get confused or convoluted or anything, because they're so vastly different. You can't sit in it and be confused. But the two of them together, I wonder whether jumping in and out of the both is going to be so similar that it is a little confusing. I don't think so. I think I'm not giving myself enough credit for my brain being smart enough to figure it out. And a lot of drivers do it every weekend. They jump in from one to the other. So I think it'll be fine. But it's an interesting experiment for sure.
Yeah. Follow-up question to that. I've also read that in these next-gen Cup Series cars, passing at IMS is incredibly difficult. So strategy and fuel save will presumably play a much bigger factor this weekend, which raises the question, how excited are you to meet Cookie Monster as the Grand Marshal of the race?
Is Cookie Monster?
Yeah.
That's so cool. But it does actually... So we've got practice at Indy. You guys, we've got practice. Like, this never happens. So hopefully that means that qualifying was better, which means I'm further up the grid, which means I won't have to deal with the learning stages and that stuff. And, I am beyond excited to meet Cookie. Can I get my picture taken?
I don't see why not. Yeah, I'm sure they'll be excited. I'm sure Cookie Monster will be excited to meet you.
Maybe I'll have him on my podcast.
Yeah, you should ask him to say D is for drafting.
T is for teamwork. Just go through the alphabet.
Look, Cookie Monster.
Really? He's a grand marshal?
He is. Yeah. No joke. 100%.
I thought Jay played it funny.
No. It's they just announced it a couple days ago.
That's cool. And as you can imagine, people are seemingly upset online about how NASCAR is losing. In 25 years, NASCAR has gone from the Intimidator to the Cookie Monster. Sad to watch a great sport implode on itself. And I was like, who's mad about the Cookie Monster?
It's such a strange choice. That
you got to get younger people involved. They're trying to get kids interested.
Sesame Street is still a thing? That was when we were children.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sesame Street's still going strong. I have a 4-year-old. He watches it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Bring it. Get him started young. Oh, speaking of young, I have a children's book out.
Yes.
Oh, you do?
I do. And it's called Cat's Magic Helmet. And it's really cool. I will send you one. If you email me your address, I will sign one and send you one, because now that I know you've got a 4-year-old. It's just about me starting karting when I was a kid and overcoming being shy and being bullied and that kind of stuff. It's got great reviews online, and I love it, and I'm very, very proud of it. So,
well, that's amazing. I can't wait to read it to my kid.
I'll define the picture, Catherine, but I sent it to my nephews, and my nephew likes to read it with my sister-in-law when he's taking his bath time. He always says, "I want the purple book," is what he calls it, and he always reads it. So I'll just send you the picture, and they're reading it because it's so, so cute. He absolutely loves it. And my brother's like, "I can't believe you're getting him into karting," and I was like, "Sorry, buddy, this is my fault, but." It's going to cost you a lot of money.
We'll wrap this up in just a minute, but I want to circle back to something that you said earlier in the interview. You said you weren't much of a car person when you were younger. Are you a car person now?
Not really.
No?
I appreciate nice cars. I like the sound of some of them. I'm not one of those people who can tell you all the stats about a car and has, like, I blistered over this Lamborghini since I was 10 years old. No, not really. I had a picture of a Gullwing Mercedes in my wall when I was a kid, and I still love that car. But I'm not... I get excited when the manufacturer that you're driving for is like, okay, what car do you want this year? And you're like, oh, do I want a truck or an SUV? That's about the extent of me being a car person, if I want.
What are you currently driving? No comment.
Chevrolet.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Love it.
We love a Chevy Tahoe in this house.
I'm kind of thinking about it, and I'm like, I'm so torn between the Tahoe and the Silverado.
Yeah.
Because I have toys. So I like to go mountain biking, and I have a bow and ski, and like I'm and golf clubs. You know, like I need to be able to throw stuff in there. And it's packed for dog. So either of those two work. I need to be able to tow.
Silverado was my first car.
Was it?
When I was 16. I loved it. And then my brother took it for a joyride. He was 12 years old and wrecked it into a wall. And my dad like, no more truck for you guys. And he sold it. And I was devastated.
Sean?
Yeah.
That's a horrible story, Jane.
I know. But when I was a kid, everybody at my high school drove the two-door Tahoes. And would put like 6-inch suspension lifts on them and like 35-inch mud tires. That was very much like the cool thing to do.
Oh yeah, we can mod your car, Catherine. It'd be great.
Yeah, we didn't have stuff like that growing up, right? We had little tiny hatchbacks to get around the little tiny English roads.
Yeah,
so I had a little Renault 5 GTS that I loved, but eventually wrapped it around and ran it. And then a Vauxhall Nova, and an Alfa Romeo green permanent four, and I think that all, which was really different, completely different experience growing up to you guys with your trucks and your Tahoe.
I know.
You gotta get from point A to point B. I do have to ask just one question, and I know you can't.
I know what you drove.
Me? My first car was a Toyota Prius, and now I drive a 2017 Toyota Tacoma. I grew up in New York City. I didn't drive till I was 18 in Florida.
Yeah, grew up in Green Point, Brooklyn, where most people don't have cars.
I didn't own cars. I didn't get my license till I was like 20-something. So, yeah, I just had my learner's permit and just drove with people in the car who had their license, so I was allowed to also drive.
How this day?
Well, we're saying this on a podcast, in case legal contacts me. I always drove with someone else who was licensed, definitely.
I promise.
Last question. Do you have any interest in doing the double of on Memorial Day weekend of doing the Indy 500 and doing the Coke 600?
I do. I don't know when, where, how, or why. But yes, I think it'd be really cool to be the first woman to do it. I think it'd be really cool to have looked back on a career that has included it. I have a lot of wants, though. So, while proposing to my sponsors what I want to do next year, it raised the question, like, what do I want to do next year? I have a lot of bucket list things. Like, I really want to do Bathurst at some point. I really want to do Bathurst, Le Mans, Indy 500 again, obviously. But what I've done the last couple of years hasn't really helped me develop as much as it could have as a race car driver. So what it's been is the like big splashy, flashy 500, trying to do Daytona, etc., etc. What I didn't give myself was the opportunity to be the best at any particular thing that I could be. And to be the best, you have to be in the car every week, and you have to be learning, and you have to be with the best team that you can be with. And I still have a few good years left in me yet before I transition and help the next Catherine or whatever that may be. And so I've been doing a lot of soul searching. And while my sponsors are awesome, Elf and Droplight, they get the most bang for their buck by doing the big splashy stuff like Indiana, like Coke 600, or I take inside Europe or whatever it may be. Because their return on that investment is huge. The amount of attention that Elf get around the 500 because of their activations and all the things that they do is bonkers when you look at it in how much value they got. So I'm kind of torn between wanting to give them the best return on their investment so they keep doing it, but also I don't just want to do these one-offs and do it for the sake of doing it. I want to be competitive. I am too competitive a person to not do that. And while I had to do it to establish myself again back in these paddocks, I really want to give myself the opportunity to be the best stock car driver that I can be. Of course, I want to do the 500. I think doing the 500 and doing the IndyCar series is two vastly different things. And would it be cool to cherry pick races? Sure. Is it the best thing to be the best race car driver that you can be? No. Am I at the stage where I just want to do that? No, I think I want to give myself a year or 2 years of like trying to learn and be the best at my craft so I can look back and go, okay, Catherine, you are a P10 NASCAR driver, or okay, you are a P20 NASCAR driver, or you are a P1 NASCAR driver. But I don't know what that is until I get the bit between my teeth and like find the money to go out and do it and then really dig in. And so, yes, doing the double is entirely possible and something that I absolutely want to do, but I really want to be fast first and competitive. And, you know, if the two happen at the same time, great. And if not, then there's no quitting me yet.
In a perfect world, would you love to be driving full-time in Xfinity or Cup Series next year?
I think so. I mean, part of me thinks I only never seen my dog.
Yeah,
it will never be home. But no, I like I said, the best way to give yourself the opportunity to be the best you can be is find an opportunity with a team that believe in you, that are a good team, and do it week in, week out like these guys do, and see where you end up. Like, yeah. Is there something that you're good enough to do on a permanent basis or not? And so, yes, I think that would be the racer in me is what wants to do that, to make money and to do fun things, then you go and cherry pick the racing terrain. But maybe I can do that down the road.
Yeah. This is mainly our audience watches a lot of F1. However, Ash is way more versed in the NASCAR world than I am. But what's so fascinating to me, I think a lot of people who don't live in the United States don't realize just how big NASCAR is here compared to all of the other racing series in the United States, and not just Cup Series. Like, you look at the ratings for Xfinity, which technically is a ladder series to Cup Series, but an Xfinity race will get more viewers than a Formula One race will in the United States.
I have, when you said that, sorry to cut you off, but I'm fascinated by these numbers. And if you look at two races ago, NASCAR Cup got 2.1 million viewers. Formula One got 1.9. IndyCar got 1 million. And Xfinity got 1 million, right?
Yeah.
Xfinity and IndyCar are the same page. But F1, because they were racing in America, or Canada, got 1.9. Then you look at other numbers and you're like, okay. Scrolling by.
You don't want that. Oh,
You look at other numbers and NASCAR Cup got 2.2 million. F1 only got 300,000 because they weren't in North America. IndyCar only got like 580,000.
Yeah.
But Xfinity got 900,000. So like way more than even F1 did.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's just like trucks even got 400,000, which is more than IndyCar did that one weekend. Right?
Right.
Like, it's a bonkers. When you look at the numbers, it's absolutely bonkers, which is why NASCAR makes sense for so many sponsors, which is why there are so many brands in NASCAR. It's because there's no series in North America that gives you those eyeballs like NASCAR does. And F1 is huge if it's racing in America, I think. And maybe that's a time thing. Do you think that's a time thing?
Because people for sure. Yeah. A lot of people don't want to wake up at 4 a.m. to watch the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. You know?
But, yeah, and the fact that Xfinity gets more than IndyCar, also crazy. Unless it's the 500, in which case I think that trumps the
right.
Yeah, of course. Ash, is there anything else you want to touch on?
I mean, I can talk to Gavin for hours, but yeah, I think I'm all set for this one. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, this was awesome. Catherine, like, thank you so much for taking the time. This is really great. Yeah.
That was awesome.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.